Go, lovely rose. Tell her that wastes my time and me, that now she knows when I resemble her to thee, how sweet and fair thou seem'st to be. Tell her that's young and shuns to have her graces spied, that hadst thou sprung in deserts where no men abide, thou shouldst have unremembered died. Small is the worth of beauty from the light retired. Bid her come forth, suffer herself to be desired, and not blush so to me admired. Then die, that she the common fate of all things rare may read in thee, how small a part of time they share that are so wondrous, sweet, and fair. Believe it or not, this is actually, perhaps only an attempt, at the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio. Yes, dear fiends, this is your beleaguered horror host, Dr. Howland Owl, and tonight I would like to take up again the story of Sindbad the Sailor and his seven voyages. But much has stood in my way. Insuperable problems. Problems of a severity which Sindbad himself would have to acknowledge. This radio station, so-called, was out of order the last two times I came in. And the second was more cruel than the first, where everything was dead and inert. I knew there was no point in attempting to do anything then. But the second time the station was completely haywire, it appeared that I was doing a show and it was going out. In fact, nobody could hear anything. And later I saw that this show had been recorded, and so I posted it. And then when I listened to it, what nobody heard was now impossible to hear. It was full of gaps, so that no word could be understood or comprehended. All that storytelling went to hell. And so I am unsure whether I should once again relate Sindbad's fifth voyage in his own words, or whether I should continue as I planned to do, indeed the entire voyage relation should have been over at this date. It is difficult when nothing works here. I am speaking over microphone number two, since microphone one is not working. But I managed to rig this up, and at a little cost to my musculoskeletal health, I am leaning over to use microphone number two. Perhaps that will carry us through this show, through the reefs and shoals and dangerous subaqueous rocks which can stave in the side of a show and send it to the bottom of oblivion. Many a time Sindbad the Sailor was shipwrecked, but he always came through, through the will, or as some would say, the caprice of Allah, the All-Merciful. I see on the chatterbox, which I have to restore each time with a mile-long URL since they don't bother to keep it up and destroy it after I put it up, that Dr. Penny is saying you loved the Gappy show. Really? Were you able to hear any of it? If so, the beginning was the part that seemed to work. Then it dropped completely out. And VJ Pussycat called in K-Rob, and K-Rob thought he had fixed it. But we were simply sending out nothing. We were shooting blanks, as it were. And this only became evident later when I went to the tattoo parlor where I worked with the young cartoonists. And they commiserated with me about the show, which had not gone out when I thought it had gone out. But at the end, I suspected this when I looked at the screen and saw all the windows on the SAM broadcaster were blank. There was no option of pressing the red button or the blue button. There was no button. There was nothing. Nothing but a sort of a skipping fake Morse code of dits and da's that was going through DJ Otto. I wrote a letter to the powers that be, an email, and they said, oh, you didn't push the button. They skimmed the letter where I tried to detail what was the matter, and I can no longer write to the groups, all the people at Radio Valencia, because the administration has made a digital barrier that I can't go through to talk to everyone. And I can't find out whether this station is infested with bugs, because somewhere along the line I got terrible bites which are now affecting everything in my life negatively. I wondered why. Several times I saw large cardboard boxes of Raid and anti-bug sprays in here. Now I do not see them. Maybe there was no problem. Or maybe there was a problem, and it was taken care of. But I labor in the darkness of ignorance, going on bit by bit, piece by piece, not understanding, only intuiting, trying, spending effort which should be funneled into a performance of an audio nature in simply keeping the damn thing afloat. Well, the chatterbox is very helpful to me. And tomorrow there will be no Reloadio. So, I believe, on the basis of what I have just read, that some of the Fifth Voyage was related. In which case, tonight, I will present the sixth and penultimate voyage of Sindbad. And later still, we hope to have a very special guest come and join us. If I can find a microphone and a pair of headphones that actually works on the other side of the table. Oh, there will be a lot of amateurish trying to plug things in and moving around from microphone to microphone. I dislike that so much. Some people, I'm looking at you, Michael Pepe, always do that anyway. But others feel it not unreasonable when invited to be on a show to be able to come in and sit down and be heard through the equipment. We shall see. Enormous human effort is sometimes necessary just to stay in one place, as Alice found when running in place with the Red Queen, or to accomplish a task which, even from the beginning, seems impossible, superhuman effort must be summoned, called from the basis of all human effort, the well beyond biophysical limitations, as in Victor Hugo's The Toilers of the Sea. This show could be considered my Durand or Derochette. But I doubt that anyone will reward me at the end, which was also the sad fate of Victor Hugo's hero, even having defeated the hideous octopus monster that haunted the grotto. What a good book that is. But of the making of books, there is no end, as the prophet says. I will make a few adjustments here in the studio, and I will unlock the door so that our guest may simply walk in when he appears. But to forestall making him sit and listen to me delivering Sinbad's account, I should start that quite soon. And so I will, after a brief test of the various elements that can only be comprised on the submixer. And so, those few fans of this show may not be bitterly disappointed this time. Or perhaps they will. And I, Dr. Howland Owl, just forked over $250 for the privilege of only occasionally being able to do one of these podcasts. It's not as if I'm made of money. Why, this is outrageous. And yet, without the dues, the entire enterprise will go under or turn over, ass over tea kettle, and be destroyed. And we wouldn't want that now, would we? It's a poor workman, runs the adage, who blames his tools. But somebody or something is to blame. In the meantime, I, your humble narrator, may be being eaten alive, chewed to pieces by the species Cimex lectularius, or perhaps merely some ordinary little soldiers of the Siphonaptera. I certainly hope so, since the other alternative is unspeakable and will cause my destruction. I hope to perform this thing riding on a wave of good old show. Let us see if it can be done. I met a witch with eyes of amber, who slowly sang a scarlet rune, shifting to an icy laughter, like the laughter of the moon. Red as a wanton's was her mouth, and fair the breast she bade me take, with a word that clove and clung, burning like a furnace flake. But from that high uplifted bosom, when I touched it with my hand, came the many-needled coldness of a glacier-taken land. And lo, the witch with eyes of amber vanished like a blown-out flame, leaving but a lichen-eaten stone that bore a blotted name. And Owl, you have heard our invocation by William Blake, Auguries of Innocence, and similar things, as our listeners know from previous. I did perform the Auguries of Innocence, but that was a number of shows ago, as I was toddling down the pike, innocently thinking that I now had a radio station or whatever this is, which would cooperate with my plans. And yet, it was not to be. Wet in here. There must have been a leak from the pipes next door. I'll see if I can trace them to the source. The usual disco inferno is happening next door. Change an uninterrupted and interesting show. For we stand on the shoulders of giants.
And let's hope they don't swat us away.
Folks, this is unbelievable. I just opened this carton here.
Oh, I have the invocation.
And there's about 20 pounds of green pastry, sugary pastry, creamy.
Mmm, the pastry of Dracula.
Just sitting there.
And rich chocolatey.
So where was this?
Just teasing you, just laughing at you.
Where was this party? What?
In my mind.
Oh, no, this is terrible.
What happened?
This is terrible.
Oh, hell.
What?
Terrible.
Well,
I told you.
Apparently, I did. And they are identical, and we will never be able to tell them apart.
You mean you've got one of those things with a David with a sticker from a Laughing Squid on the outside?
No. Now, please bring this back here.
Well, when you look at that.
Oh, my God.
Oh, what are those?
Can
oh,
I
what
have those? One? Oh, well, there's so much for that one. So, you see, I was simply going to... but thank you for your solicitousness. Oh, well, all right, here's a backup in case anything happens to that one.
I'll take that one because that one is actually mine.
This one is yours?
Yes,
now both
it is.
Of them are
thank
here.
You.
Well,
very good.
Okay.
That's
so,
what the show is now.
Well, I already had one anyway. That
exactly.
Wasn't mine.
Yeah, me
right.
Too.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I don't hang out with
says radio.
I'm going to go stand over here.
I'm famous for stealing lighters.
Me too. I used to do it on purpose.
Yeah. that's different. That's a felony.
Oh, that's.
That's a felony.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, there is that. Yeah.
Deliberately. But, like, did you plan to steal it?
It started when people still smoke cigarettes, and I had this weird idea that if I stole their lighter, they wouldn't smoke as many cigarettes, which you know was weird. So, but
wow.
And then
so
over the years,
like it was a social intervention.
Yeah, it was. I'm really thinking of the other person.
You're like,
It's not that I want the lighter.
So, so it's like it's incredibly generous.
Altruistic. Yeah, all the way. All the way. Yeah, that's me. Caring about the other, the people. Wow. I care about all the people.
I mean, you know, you're like just one of those guys. You'll give him the shirt off his back, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what virtually everybody says in every murder or crime story.
Yeah, he wouldn't hurt a fly.
He would help anyone. He was so funny and smart and
You know what you're doing right now is fake broadcasting, right? I mean, I hear it's not because I hear voices, it's because it's real. It's true. I know
voices
it's true.
Again. It's really happening.
He's hearing voices.
Well,
this ain't happening, man. This ain't happening.
I had always hoped that the show would be real. I didn't, but I mean,
well, this is
I kind of had given up, though.
Don't give up. Never surrender. Never give up.
And just don't.
Is there error? You don't know.
Someday it'll be real. Well, yep.
Someday is now.
We always hope. Well, and we hope July 5th.
The theme of Burning Man this year is tomorrow,
and
today.
And July 7th. What?
The godlike Michael Pepe.
Oh, yeah.
With the two little devilly red Michael Pepe beating away at
him. Yeah, he's sort of like an Edwardian referee.
What is their theme?
With a Buffon. Is that what they
even
call it?
Even Tintin Buffon has the
like a crazy
devil
wrestling
form, which urges him to do evil.
Yeah.
Over
and
over
the square
and over.
70s glasses.
Oh, the 70s, you know, that says it all.
I tell you, I don't think my hands are as old looking as his hands.
It all depends.
He has a 90-year-old hands. I've mentioned this before.
Who does? Who has a 90-year-old hands?
The Michael Pepe in Twitch's stream. If you notice, it's very
the real Michael Pepe.
Some trick
his
of the
hands
lighting.
Are very wrinkled.
Some strange.
You're talking about the real, not the AI Pepe.
I'm talking about the real AI Pepe. Well, the AI.
Well,
Pepe.
According to what I hear, if your hands are wrinkled and your veins are showing and all that stuff, that gnarly look, it's because you're not hydrated enough.
Oh.
Consume more liquid and
is
you'll plump
it?
Out and you won't. Your hands will look younger.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what they say. Drink lots of liquids. Drink water. Don't drink alcohol.
Weird, wild stuff.
You know how, once again, at Burning Man, they say piss clear because if your pee isn't colored, then you are hydrated. But if it's orange, you need to be drinking some water pronto.
Okay. Right, right. It's a little too rich. Sometimes if you pee, you know, after supper, you'll get like a really red pee.
Well, the thing is, you're trying trying to purify, trying to clean yourself out, but without adequate fluids in your hydraulically operated body.
That's what's so disappointing about the pee after you've been drinking, like beer, for example. You know, you might have a long pee, and then after it's all over, you look down, and the water's almost clear. And you realize it's all water, you know.
Well, it's all gone is what it is. And it takes more moisture with it.
I suppose so. Well,
yes, alcohol dries you out, actually.
You often, when you finish taking a shower, you get very thirsty. I'm always very thirsty after a long shower.
Well, a certain Reverend Baby Bear likes to drink a beer while she's taking a shower.
Really? Wow.
And isn't that charming?
Yeah.
I've always loved that image.
People do fall in the bathtub and injure themselves.
So I've always tried not to.
Fall in the bathtub. Let's not discuss such dire possibilities.
That gets you in trouble.
Yes, let's let a warning out to you folks out there. We're not advocating drinking in the shower. We really are.
It works for somebody. I mean,
well, I guess, but we just don't want the.
The tales of Sinbad the Sailor. The relation of the fifth voyage. If, as my faithful correspondents indicate, our last coherent podcast told the story of the fifth voyage, in which Sinbad, the hapless traveler, visited the killer apes and other creatures. It is time for the sixth voyage of Sinbad. Companions and dear guests, I was sitting one day, taking the air before my door, and feeling as happy as I had ever felt, when I saw a group of merchants passing in the street who had every appearance of returned travelers. This sight recalled to me how joyful a thing it is to return from journeying, to see the birthland after far voyage, and the thought made me long to travel again. I equipped myself with merchandise of price suitable for the sea and left the city of Baghdad for Bassora. There I found a great ship filled with merchants and notables, as well provided with goods for trading as myself. So I had my bales carried on board, and soon we peacefully set sail from Bassora. We sailed from place to place and from city to city, buying and selling and rejoicing in the new sights which met our gaze. But one day, as we were lying on the deck with a feeling of perfect safety, we heard despairing cries, and looking up, saw that they were uttered by the captain, who also threw his turban far away from him, and, beating himself on the face, pulled out handfuls of his beard. We clustered round him, asking what the matter was, and he answered, "All good folk here assembled learn that we have been driven from the seas we knew into an unknown ocean, where we shall surely perish unless Allah sends something to save us. Let us pray to him." So saying, the captain climbed the mast and was about to trim the sails, when a great wind rose and, striking us full in the face, broke our rudder to pieces. Just as we were passing a high mountain, the captain swarmed down the mast, crying, "There is no power or might save in Allah. None can arrest the force of destiny. My friends, we are altogether lost." While the passengers were weeping and saying farewell to each other, the sea rose in her fury and broke our vessel into fragments against the mountain of which I have spoken. We were all thrown into the water, where some were drowned, and others, among whom was myself, were able to save themselves by clinging to the lower crags. Now, this mountain rose straight up from the strand of a large island, the beaches of which were covered with the remains of wrecked ships, and every kind of jetsam. The place where we landed was strewn with a multitude of bales, from which rich merchandise and costly ornaments had escaped. I walked among these scattered treasures, and soon found a little river of fresh water, which, instead of flowing into the sea, as do all other rivers, came from a cleft in the mountain, and, running inland, at last plunged into a cave at the foot of it and disappeared. Nor was that all. The banks of this stream were thick underfoot with rubies and other colored precious stones, and all crumbling with diamonds and pieces of gold and silver. Also, its bed was littered with gems beyond price instead of pebbles, and the whole region beneath and beside the water blazed with the reflected light of so much riches that the eyes of the beholder were dazzled. Chinese and Comoran aloes of the first quality grew about the water. In this island there was a stream of raw liquid amber of the color of tar which flowed down to the seashore, being melted to the consistency of boiling wax by the rays of the sun. Great fish would come out of the sea and drink greedily of this substance, which heated their bellies so that after a certain time they would vomit upon the surface of the water. There it became hard and changed both its nature and color, and at last it was carried back to the beach in the form of ambergris, which scented the whole island. The liquid amber, which the fish did not swallow, also spread a perfume of musk about the shore. These riches were useless to man, because none might touch upon that island and leave it alive, seeing that every ship which came near was dashed to pieces by the force of the waves. Those of us who had been saved from the wreck remained in sorrowful case upon the beach, desolate in the middle of great wealth and starving among the material for many feasts. Such food as we had, we scrupulously divided, but my companions, who were not used like myself to the horrors of starvation, ate their shares in one or two meals and began to die off in a few days. I was more careful, eating sparsely and only once a day. Also, I had found a separate supply of provision, of which I said nothing to my friends. We who lived washed those who died, and wrapping them in shrouds made up of the rich fabrics which strewed the shore, buried them in the sand. To add to the harshness and hardships of the survivors, a sickness of the belly broke out among us, caused by the moist air of the sea. All but myself of those who had not starved died of it, and I dug with my own hands a grave for the last of my companions. In spite of my prudent abstention, very little of my food remained. So, seeing that death was not far off, I wept and cried aloud, "Ah, why did you not die while there remained comrades who would have washed you and given you to the earth? There is no power or might save in Allah." Then I began to bite the hands of my despair. I rose and dug a deep grave for myself, saying, "When I feel that my last moment is at hand, I will drag myself here and die in my grave, for surely the wind will bury me with sand." As I was engaged in this work, I cursed myself bitterly for my foolishness in voyaging again after having learned 5 times that death lies in wait for the wanderer. "How many times did you repent and begin again?" I said to myself. Had you not enough riches laid by in Baghdad to suffice for the most reckless expenditure throughout two lifetimes? Do these thoughts succeeded a more practical one, suggested by the appearance of the river? As Allah lives, I thought, this stream must have both a beginning and an end. Now I see the beginning, but the end is hidden from me. The water flows below the mountain. Therefore, I will wager that it comes out the other side in one fashion or another. If that is so, my only hope of escape is to construct some kind of a vessel which will bear me down the current of the stream and through its subterranean course. If such is my destiny, I will find a way of safety beyond. If I die, it will be no worse than the starvation which waits me here. A little cheered by this desperate chance, I rose and began to put my plan into execution. I collected the larger branches of the Chinese and Kumaran aloes and bound them together with cords. Using this as a foundation, I built a raft with ship's planks and furnishings, which was nearly but not quite as broad as the river. Then I loaded the raft with some large sacks of emeralds, pearls, and other stones, choosing always the biggest from the heaps which surrounded me. I also placed on board some bales of chosen ambergris and the rest of my provisions. When the craft balanced well, I went on board, carrying two planks by way of oars, and confided myself to Allah, remembering these words of the poet: out of the country of oppression depart and save your spirit whole. There are 1,000 lands and but one soul, so leave the land and keep the soul's possession. Nothing unwritten shall surprise you, nothing which has not been for ages. So hurry not for counsel to the sages, but stay at home and let your soul advise you. My raft was hurried by the current under the arch of the cave, and at once began to bang against the sides violently, while my head often came into contact with a rocky roof which I could not see because of the sudden darkness. Very soon I wished that I could return to the sands of my starvation, but the current grew stronger and stronger as I descended the underground river, and the course of it went sometimes wide and sometimes narrow, so that the moving shadows thickened about me and confused my eyes. Leaving go of my useless oars, I threw myself flat down upon the raft to save my head from being crushed by any projection, and, worn out by fear and exhaustion, fell into a deep sleep. This sleep or swoon of mine seemed to last for more than a year. When I came to myself, I was in full daylight, and opening my eyes, saw that I was lying upon the grass in a vast tract of meadowland, and that my raft was fastened by the side of a river. About me were many Indians and Abyssinians. When these men saw that I was awake, they began to speak to me, but I did not understand their language, and so could not answer them. I thought I was in a dream, until a man came towards me who wished me peace in pure Arabic, saying, "Who are you, and where have you come from, and why have you journeyed to our country? We are farmers who, arriving to water our fields and plantations in this place, saw you come downstream asleep upon a raft, which we stopped and fastened here by the bank, while we laid you upon the grass to have your slumber out. We wished you to wake yourself, so that you should not be afraid. Tell us, by what strange adventure you have come to this place." "As Allah lives, my master," I answered, "first give me something to eat, for I am starving. Then ask me as many questions as you like." The man hastened to bring me food, and I ate until I was satisfied and strengthened. Feeling my soul come back to its body, I thanked Allah and congratulated myself upon my escape from the underground river. Then I told the men who surrounded me the whole story of my adventures on the island. They marveled much at what they heard and began talking together in their unknown tongue, and he who spoke Arabic translated their thoughts to me as he had translated my tale to them. It appeared that they wished to conduct me to their king, that he might hear my adventures for himself. When I gladly consented, they formed a procession and led me to the city, carrying with them my raft, just as it was, loaded with ambergris and with sacks of jewels. The king kindly received me, and at his request I gave a complete recital of all that had happened to me, without omitting a single detail. But it would be useless to repeat it in this place. The king of Serendib, for such was the name of the island, congratulated me heartily upon having come alive out of such perils, and in return I hastened to open my bales and sacks in his presence, that he might see that there was profit attached to strange and fantastic voyaging. The king admired my collection, for he was very learned in the matter of precious stones, and was pleased to accept samples which I offered him of every kind of jewel, together with a few large pearls and pure ingots of gold and silver. In recognition of my generosity, he loaded me with honors and gave me lodging in his own palace, so that from that day I was his friend, and the friend of the chief nobles in the island. They asked me about my own country, and I described it to them. Then I questioned them about theirs and received some interesting answers. I learned that the island of Serendib was 24 parsangs long by 24 wide, that it held the highest mountain in the whole world, on which our father Adam had lived for certain of his days, and that it was rich in pearls and precious stones, though not so fine as mine, and many coconut palms. One day, the king of Serendib questioned me concerning the internal affairs of Baghdad and the government of the caliphate, Harun al-Rashid. I told him how just and benevolent our ruler was, and laid considerable stress upon his virtues and excellent qualities. The king of Serendib marveled at what I told him, and said, "I see that the caliphate is versed in wisdom and the true art of government. I have conceived an affection for him. Through the account which you have given me, therefore I am very anxious to send him some present worthy of himself, and appoint you the bearer of it. I am entirely at your orders, my master," I answered. "I swear that I will faithfully remit your gift to the caliphate, and that he will be enchanted by it. I will also tell him that you are a good friend, and he may count on your alliance." Without delay, the king gave orders to his chamberlains. The present which he sent me by Harun al-Rashid consisted of a large jar half a foot high and a finger thick, carved from a single ruby of perfect color, filled with round white pearls as large as nuts, a carpet made from the skin of a gigantic serpent, with scales each as large as a dinar, and having this virtue, that whatsoever sick man lay down upon it should be healed. 200 balls of camphor in its purest state, each as large as a pistachio, 2 elephant's tusks, 12 cubits long, and 2 cubits round the base, and lastly, a beautiful girl of Serendib, smothered in rich jewelry. At the same time, The king gave me a letter for the commander of the faithful, saying, make my excuses to the caliphate for sending so small a present, and tell him that I love him with all my heart. Yet, Sindbad, if you would rather stay in our kingdom, you shall be in everything our favorite. And we will send another messenger to Baghdad instead of you. As Allah lives, O King of Time, I cried, your generosity is a royal generosity. My spirit bows beneath your gifts, but there is a boat just starting for Bassorah, and I am very anxious to go aboard her and see my friends, my children, and my native land once more. The king, who did not wish to constrain me against my will, at once sent for the captain of the ship and the merchants who would sail with me, and gave me into their safe keeping with 1,000 recommendations, paying my passage money himself, and presenting me with many precious gifts, which I still keep in memory of him. After saying farewell to the king and to all the friends whom I had made in that delightful island, I set sail and at last came, through the mercy of Allah, safely to Bassorah and thence to Baghdad. The first thing I did on landing was to hasten to the palace, where I was granted a reception by the Prince of Believers. I kissed the earth between his hands, and giving him the letter and present which I had been entrusted, I told him all my adventures, from beginning to end. When the caliphate had read the letter from the king of Serendib and examined the presents, he asked me if the monarch who had sent them was really as rich as these things seemed to imply. O commander of the faithful, I answered, I can witness that the king of Serendib does not exaggerate, and further that he adds to his wealth both justice and wise government. He is the sole Qadi in his kingdom, and the people are so contented that there is never friction between them and their ruler. Indeed, he is worthy of your friendship, O king. What you have told me, and the letter which I have just read, returned the caliphate, prove to me that the king of Serendib is a good man, filled with wisdom and worldly knowledge. Happy is the people which he governs, say I. Then the caliphate presented me with a robe of honor and rich gifts, and after rewarding me with privileges, commanded the cleverest scribes of his palace to write down all my story, that it might be treasured among the papers of his reign. I hastened to my own house, in my own street, and lived there, surrounded by riches and respect, among my friends and relations, quite forgetting my past troubles and having no other care than to squeeze from this life all the joys of which it is capable. Such is the story of my sixth voyage. Tomorrow, dear guests, if Allah wills, I will tell you the tale of my seventh voyage, which is fuller of astonishing prodigies than the other six put together. Then Sindbad the sailor feasted his guests and dismissed them, giving a further 100 gold pieces to Sindbad the porter, who returned home, marveling at all he had heard. Next morning, Sindbad the landsman made his prayer and returned, as he had been asked to do, to the palace of the other Sindbad. When all the guests were assembled and had eaten, drunken, chatted, laughed, and listened to fair music, they ranged themselves in a silent circle around their host, who described to them the account of his further and final voyage, in which strange, gigantic monsters were encountered and other wonders hardly known and understood by those who live in cities and the haunts of men. This tale will conclude the relation of the seventh voyage, of the seven voyages of Sinbad the sailor, if through the mercy and merciful will of Allah the Almighty, this so-called radio station will allow that tale to be told.
It occurs to the merchants that not everything that is mentioned is an injunction to do that thing.
Well, yes.
To follow it, to believe it. Well, we're not ordering people to do things. We're just presenting true. Entertainment.
It's true, but the show has so much influence over the very young people.
Yes,
you know,
I know.
Oh, yeah?
You know, don't listen to Taylor Swift anymore.
Is that what we said?
That would be the end of... No, we would never say that, of course.
Certainly not.
They'd frighten the children.
Yes, we wouldn't want to do that, would we?
No. That's but you know, just even the
my friends. I am anticipating David Normal, the world traveler who has visited more places than Sinbad, to come in and be my guest very soon. Let us hope no one diverts him from his intention.
It really dislocates
all right.
Some stocks. And,
lay it on me. What did I say?
And well, that's buried down the memory hole now. We can't discuss. We're not even going to...
Better to throw the food in the street than give the kiddies too much to eat. But better belly burst than good meat spoiled.
That's right. Well, we're going to neither deny nor state that Hal ever said anything that was dangerous or caused problems.
You can pick
heavens,
your
no.
And you can pick your nose, yes. But you can't pick your friend's nose.
I've said this many times, and yet people continue to pick.
Yeah, you tell them to keep their hands to themselves.
Like Tracy Feldman, who...
we don't need specific examples.
Who, you know, handed out little $5 pieces that had a picture of a giant picking its own nose.
Well, not exactly. That was Thomas Jefferson, and I did the art there.
At Burning Man.
But they made a huge... giant hand and a huge giant face, and this contraption did pick its own nose, powered by hipsters running in an enormous hamster wheel. And on the obverse side of the coin, on one side showing Jefferson picking his nose, the other showed a hipster in shorts running inside the giant wheel. These wooden tokens are now highly sought after collector's items.
It was awful fun.
What?
The show? Fun. Yeah.
You mean when you were barking doggedly? I'm sure you weren't Michael Puppy. No, actually.
Michael Puppy. That's terrible.
I growled and yowled for that attraction. Yes. And we brought in a big crowd. There were a few injuries of enthusiastic people falling forward in the wheel.
Yeah, that wheel wanted to keep going. You couldn't just stop.
Going all night long.
That's too bad.
Well, it was a big deal back in the day. I realize Puzzling Evidence doesn't like anything about Burning Man because it's not the way it was in 1995. But places change, institutions also.
Computer algorithm in the electronics in the trunk of the tree. The entire thing is artificial because you're not allowed to bring any living thing into Burning Man. You can't bring a plant. You can't bring a flower in. If they catch you doing that, they'll destroy your plant at the gate. And the funny thing is, a bunch of years ago, it was supposed to be the Green Burning Man. Do you remember that? So people brought plants and things, and they were horrified when they were seized and burned at the gate. Because you couldn't bring
the plants were, not the people.
Grass or something in, but there was an attraction that had a whole field of plastic grass that you could lie in.
So what, you know, they should have warned people beforehand, you know.
Maybe they did, but not everybody read the fine print. No, they were trying to be in with the theme of being green. Right. So they were bringing some greens.
Right.
But bringing an animal or a plant is forbidden. It's introducing.
It would be mean to bring an animal there.
It's harming the animal, and it's, you know, it's, wow.
And yet, in my time, I have seen a chipmunk running along. It probably hitchhiked with some human.
Take the plant away.
A chicken that someone brought, and even a dog. Both of these are examples, in my opinion, of a species of animal cruelty.
What was the theme the year you were there with Philo?
I used to be afraid no one would ever wed me, and I'd die sour old maid. Now I'm married and I set me down to weep, 'cause my husband chaws tobacco and he snores in his sleep. Oh Lord, I wish I was a single girl again. Lord, I wish I was a single girl again.
I wish I was a single boy again.
That was the Maddox Brothers and the Incredible Rose singing I Wish I Was a Single Girl Again, with Lulu Bell and Scotty at Four Star 1951. And now, this.
The aliens.
Oh, yeah?
What were they called? The,
Little aliens.
That was the theme of the Burning Man that year?
Yeah. Extraterrestrials.
What year is that?
Well, that's what
2000,
I'm
maybe?
2000, okay.
I think.
Because that was the same year Stang was there.
Yeah.
And Philo.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, Michael Pepe, you were there that year.
No, 2002.
2002, VJ says.
It's what?
And it was a UFO?
Well, there were UFO odors.
That's just crazy talk.
Well, the whole idea, I think that I'm thinking like, no, could have been closer to the 99, too.
The wreck of the old 99. You know, I was there one year, somewhat recently. Don't ask me which one, because they all blur together. And they built two steam locomotives and a section of track. And these engines raced together and crashed into each other. And all sorts of the usual fireworks and explosions went off to satisfy the vast, restless, rumbustious crowd at Burning Man.
A beautiful experience of your own. And it represented some kind of extraterrestrial deity, I think, or something.
That I vaguely remember.
And there was a sort of a fictional race of extraterrestrial people called the...